Hello, I'm Michael Enright. Welcome to Rewind, where we travel back in time to hear voices from the past. If you like to listen to old radio, you might have heard this clip. It's the voice of radio reporter Herbert Morrison, who was a first-hand witness to the crash and burning of the mighty airship Hindenburg in 1937.
It's starting to rain again. The rain had flagged up a little bit.
It bursts into flames. Get it started. It's flashing, and it's crashing. It's crashing terrible. Oh, my. Get out of the way, please. It's burning, bursting into flames, and it's falling on the mooring fast, and all the folks between it. This is terrible. This is one of the worst catastrophes in the world. 400 or 500 feet into the sky, and it's a terrific crash, ladies and gentlemen. The smoke and the flames now, and the flame is crashing to the ground, not quite to the mooring mast. All the humanity and all the passengers is speeding around it. I can't talk, ladies and gentlemen. Honestly, it's just laying there a massive smoking wreckage. Honestly, I can hardly breathe. I'm going to step inside while I cannot see it. Listen, folks, I'm going to have to stop for a minute because I've lost the voice. This is the worst thing I've ever witnessed.
Herbert Morrison, witness to the crash of the German airship Hindenburg. 36 people died, and it put an end to the dreams of a huge helium or hydrogen-filled passenger airship. That disaster spawned movies, several books, and much speculation about the cause of the crash. But did you know that 7 years earlier there was an airship with Canadian connections that had an even higher death toll? It was called the R-101, and 48 people of 54 crew members died in that disaster, among them some prominent politicians and designers. The British government had launched an ambitious plan to build a series of airships, huge cigar-shaped dirigibles, to transport both passengers and mail from Britain to the countries of the Empire, primarily Canada, India, and Australia. The R-101 was one of them. But, and now here's the Canadian connection, in July 1930, the R-100, built by a rival British company, left for Canada and made it to Montreal in a record 78 hours. That was just half the time it took the fastest ocean liner. There were throngs of people who met the ship when it landed. The R-100 was moored in Montreal for 12 days, with more than 100,000 people visiting the airship each day. It then took a 24-hour flight carrying passengers to Ottawa, Toronto, and Niagara Falls. The trip back to England took only 57 and a half hours, a triumph. Surely this was the future of air travel. In the wake of this success, the R-101 took off in October 1930 to attempt a trip to India. This time it ended in disaster. The airship crashed into a hillside in northern France, killing 48 of the 54 people aboard. Among the dead were Lord Christopher Thompson, Secretary of State for Air in the British government, many other senior government officials, and nearly all the designers of the dirigible. In the documentary you'll hear today, you'll hear from five of the only six survivors who recount the disastrous flight, as well as other people involved in the voyage. It was made by the brilliant CBC documentary maker Len Chappell in 1966. And this year, since it's the 85th anniversary, we thought we would re-air it. Here now, The Great Grey Ghost.
I watched all the crew go down in a very large lorry, and they were all in uniform, of course, and they were leaning over the sides and yelling their heads off, but I don't think they had any apprehensions at all. And, of course, there was very much competition amongst all the men to be chosen to go. Those who were turned down were very upset. They were all anxious to go.
The age of the great dirigibles was a romantic age filled with dreams and frustrations. The men who built them and flew them were a breed apart. Lighter than air was a way of life, and though theirs was a frustrating and frustrated romance, they have almost to a man remained faithful to their first love, that giant of the air, the great gray ghost, the airship. In this age of Superman, Buck Rogers, and dreamed of rocket trips to the moon and Mars, a whole generation of air-minded youngsters has grown to maturity, never having had to conjure such pulse-quickening names as Shenandoah, Hindenburg, Macon, R-100, Zeppelin, and R-101. Though almost every one of the giant rigids, they were bigger than most of the great ocean liners, came to an unhappy end, none was more tragic than Britain's R-101. Among her passengers were Lord Thompson, the Air Minister in Ramsay MacDonald's Labour government, and Sir Sefton Brancker, the Director of Civil Aviation, and almost all of the officers and men who built her. She left her mooring tower at Cardington, Bedfordshire, at 6:36 p.m., October 4th, 1930. Her trials had been too short and were inconclusive. But her captain and crew were under political and public pressure following her sister ship R-100's successful flight to Canada the previous spring. Though the weather was turning bad, there was no thought of turning back. Less than 8 hours later, she was a white-hot, 777-foot skeleton of stainless steel on a hill outside Beauvais in northern France. 48 of her 54-man human cargo died in the searing blast of 5,500,000 cubic feet of hydrogen. At 2:08, on the morning of October 5th, on a windswept hillside soaked in rain, Britain's lighter-than-air age came to an end. Five of the six who lived tell the tale of those last hours of the great gray ghost, the R-101.
Of course, the ship was already on the mooring mast, and it was rather a fine morning, and we spent the better part of the day up to early afternoon taking in stores and touching up everywhere to make the ship more or less equal to a task of a flight to India.
It was quite a pleasant day. I can remember now, a sunny day, normal October weather. There was no rain during the day.
I think they were all pretty cheerful. And I'd been on airships a long time, and my wife never saw any danger at all. She was down with my son, who was then about two, I think, to see us off. We had some trouble with one of the engines, and that delayed the actual takeoff. And by that time, it was pouring with rain, and the wind had got up, so it didn't look very good prospects for what we'd look forward to being a good flight.
From then on, we were preparing to leave at any moment, as you might say. But, of course, awaiting the reports from the meteorological people over the course we should be flying.
There were crowds of cars there, of course. Of course, they were cheering like nothing on earth and hooting.
The main memory I have was the top of the mast on the evening she left. It was blowing more or less a gale, and I was hoping all the time that they would cancel the flight because of the conditions. But they didn't, and of course, eventually I got the order from the bow of the ship. Atherston was the first officer, and he passed the order from the captain to me to slip, which, of course, I passed to the man with the lever, and he slipped, and she gradually rose out of the cup in the mast, and away she went.
We flew over Bedford, of course, and made our way to London, where we flew round London.
Captain Irwin sent his first message at 8:21. Over London, all well. Moderate rain, base of low clouds, 1,500 feet. Wind, 240 degrees, 25 miles per hour. Course now set for Paris. Intend to proceed via Paris, Tours, Toulouse, and Narbonne.
In those days in the Air Ministry, there was a system of duty officers. And
The Air Ministry's duty officer that night was Maurice Deane.
These were in the days where we worked on Saturdays, so I came on duty at, I suppose, about 2 o'clock, and remained on duty over the weekend. The airship took off about 6:30, and she flew over London at about 8:30. I've been trying to remember whether I actually went on the roof. We were on the top floor of the building in Kingsway, and my recollection is that I went over on the roof and heard the airship, but didn't actually see her.
and then we struck out across the channel.
From then on, the weather deteriorated hour by hour.
Crossing coast in vicinity of Hastings. It is raining hard, and there is a strong southwesterly wind. Cloud base is at 1,500 feet. After a good getaway from Mooring Tower, ship circled Bedford before setting course. Reached London at 2,000 hours and then set course for Paris. Gradually increasing height to avoid high land. Engines running well at cruising speed, giving 54.2 knots. Ship behaving well generally, and we have already begun to recover water ballast.
We broke into watches at 8 p.m. Now, this is the time when I should have taken over our engine, the engine that Mr. Bell and I was keeping watches on. But just shortly after 8 p.m., we had a slight defect in the engine, which occupied a couple of hours correcting it, which entailed both of us being together at the same time in the engine car. Having got it corrected, Arthur Bell suggested that I leave him and get into my bunk and relieve him at 2 a.m.
We weren't very high because the ship was heavy. We never did get very high. And I should think when we went over the channel, we were about 1,000 feet. And we could actually see the waves blowing up pretty high, you know. It just made us sure that the weather outside wasn't too good. Because in an airship, you know, it's pretty comfortable. So we didn't take too much notice of that, and we got across to France.
I'm Michael Enright, and today on Rewind we air a documentary that first aired in 1966 about the R-101, the British-made airship that crashed into a hill in France on its maiden voyage in 1930. Here once more is one of the six survivors.
The chief engineer, Bill Gent, and I were in the smoke room discussing things, and Captain Irwin came in, and we started talking generally about the trip, and he seemed fairly happy about the way machinery was running, but he was worried about the low altitude they were flying at and the bumpy weather, and he would like to have been able to fly higher by releasing ballast. Some of the ballast tanks, which normally contained water, were filled with fuel. And the last thing a pilot will do is to let go his emergency fuel if he can possibly help it. After that, he went back to the control cabin, and I advised Bill Gent to turn in, and I would look after the machinery, as he would have a very stiff time refueling at Ismailia. Sometime after that, I went round the engines again to see that everything was running satisfactorily and returned to the smoke room to sit down for a while.
Well, I thought when I was off duty and lay in my bunk, I could see through an open doorway or hatchway the main gas bags, and the frame of the ship seemed to be rolling around the gas bag. I'd never noticed this before, because on previous flights we'd never flown with five engines going ahead. We'd always flown with four engines for going ahead and one for going astern. We'd gone out previously on the Thursday to carry out full-speed trials with five engines going ahead, but the trials were never completed because one engine broke down.
There wasn't a soul about when I went in. They all got into the bunks or somewhere, glad to get hidden away. So I don't know why. The storm outside, probably, and the ship wasn't behaving too well. The only noise I could hear when I got up into our cruise quarters, where I had to sleep until 2 o'clock, was the noise of the gas bags lifting and falling and rolling about, and the creaking of the ship's frame as she was battling against this storm. It had come into, really, a gale force wind and heavy rain.
Anyway, she went on. And later in the evening, at about midnight, we got a report from the airship about how she was getting on. And this was an open message and was released to the press. And shortly after this, I went to bed.
2400 GMT, 15 miles southwest of Abbeville. Average speed, 33 knots. Wind, 243 degrees, 35 miles per hour. Altimeter height, 1,500 feet. Air temperature, 51 degrees Fahrenheit. Weather, intermittent rain. Cloud nimbus at 500 feet. After an excellent supper, our distinguished passengers smoked a final cigar and, having sighted the French coast, have now gone to bed to rest after the excitement of their leave-taking. All essential services are functioning satisfactorily. The crew have settled down to watch-keeping routine.
I changed watch at 2 o'clock.
At 2:03, I felt a tug in my bunk on my arm, and that was from the engineer charging of that watch, who had just completed visiting the engineers in the cars, and he left Mr. Bell from the after engine car, and he was wondering where I was. So I jumped out of the bunk, and he would insist on me having a sip of cocoa, which he'd made. I had to leave the ship to get down into the engine by going down a rope ladder about 10 feet long, which was secured from the belly of the ship to the engine gondola. That's where I noticed the weather at its worst. It stripped the toggles off my duffel coat, which I had on, to keep off the rain. It was then perhaps 4 and a half. So while she was explaining to me about the behaviour of the engine since it had been corrected from its defect, the ship took a sudden dive. And in a matter of a second, she was level, on a level keel again.
When she went in the first dip, it must have been that woke me up, because we seemed to be in the dip when I sort of come to life. And she's levelled out, and I got the impression she actually climbed after that. But that is not universally agreed that she climbed, but I got the impression she did.
And suddenly the engine room telegraph rang from full speed ahead to dead slow, and the ship took over slight diving attitudes. The practice was to repeat the engine room telegraph order back on your engine telegraph instrument and then carry out the order, which I did, and I throttled the engine down to slow.
I shut the engine right off because I thought, well, if we hit the ground, we stand a better chance with the engine shut off than what we will with the propeller running, which would slung us right back up into the ship, you see.
Just after the first dip, I think it would be between the two dips, the chief coxswain, Mr. Hunt, came my way to the switchboard and said, "We're down, lads."
And I was then leaning, looking out of the hatchway to the power car, all was in darkness below, and while I was looking out at this hatchway, the ship suddenly stuck at the nose and blew up.
Nothing actually fell on me, but everything that was loose, the tables and chairs and crockery, everything that was loose just scattered all over the place, and it was a terrific noise. And as she struck the ground, it wasn't the type of bump that you might get if you hit a wall with something. It was a crunching sound, and there was a terrible noise of wires and everything rattling as we rattled down.
We hit at a pretty steep angle, which, when she hit the ground, that left me in the after car with Joe Binks fairly high up in the air still. Well, she burst into flames practically as she hit, and we were away up in the air, and we said, "This is it," and said goodbye to each other, as you do if you've been working with somebody for years. We shook hands, and at that moment there was a water surfacing tank just over the top of our car. And luckily for us, the jolt of the first hit must have sprung a leak in it, and the water come down through the top of the car, and I pulled Joe Binks to me, and we both stood together in this water while the main flames passed around us, you see. Well, eventually we hit the ground with a pretty heavy bump because there was no gas to hold us up then, you see. And I got knocked about a bit, and we stood silent and looked at each other for a moment. And I said to Joe, we can get out of this. So he said, yes, but we better hang on a bit, he said, because we should be burnt to death if we go out there now. Well, we found some cleaning rags and soaked up the water that was still in the bottom of the car. By that time, all the bottom of the car was burning. And we wrapped these cleaning rags round our face and climbed out.
We jumped out of the car about 20 feet, possibly. But it was cushioned by bushes and the framework. But the frame was very, very hot. And there was a fire there all the time.
When the sudden crash came, I went to the smoke room door, which was a fireproof wall with a door in it, opened the door, and was met by a sheet of flame. The ship was on fire. So I shut the door, walked back, or staggered back, and I kicked my way through the fireproof lining of the smoke room, and by the time I'd got through that onto the buckled girders, I found that the outer fabric of the cover had all been burnt away. And I fell into the top of a tree and slid down onto the ground.
At the particular portion of the ship where I was, there was only one other. And he was the assistant steward. And he had a bunk on the other side of the compartment from me. He was out of bed pretty quickly. And he left and came back and bent down and grabbed his slippers from underneath the bunk. I don't know what happened to him after that. Just went. So I didn't see him anymore. I think the urgency was too great to be frightened. I knew I had to get out, and I wanted to get out. I knew there was a water tank, and this was the reason I went in this particular direction. There was a huge water tank of fresh water on the passageway just outside the kitchen door. I was hoping that I might use that water for myself, and I went in that direction. When I got there, that tank had fallen over in the crash, and there was no water left. So I jumped into the covers from that point, hoping to break through the covers into the open air. There was nothing doing because that was firmly on the ground. And then I moved towards the side of the ship where the covers were blazing. Suddenly, they tore apart as they tensed onto the ground outside.
I lay down on the floor on top of an oil tank and gave things up as a bad job. The next thing I knew, I was climbing out through these girders and dropped down into some bushes, which the power car was resting in. And I ran away from the ship to get away from the fire. As I ran away, an explosion took place, which I presume was a fuel tank blowing up. So I carried on running with my hands up in the air, the palms facing the direction I was going. So I must have put my hands in the air to keep the wind off the backs of my hands, which were badly burnt. But then I stopped and I looked behind me, and there were sparks falling behind me. And I thought, I must be on fire. So I had an overall suit on, which I presume was smouldering, and as I ran through the wind, it was blowing sparks off the material, which was not burning. So I pulled these overalls off, taking off my flying boots, and put my feet back in the flying boots without doing up the zip fasteners again, and turned back from the way I'd come and ran along the side of the wood again with my hands in the air, my head down. And I suddenly ran into the side of a cow. Then I spotted two figures running towards me in long white smocks. And as they got near me, I heard them mutter something about dirigible and explosion, and they took me to a waiting car on the road and drove into Beauvais town.
One of only six survivors of the crash of the R-101, a great airship made by the British and intended for travel between Britain and the countries of its empire, which included, of course, Canada. I'm Michael Enright, and this is Rewind, where every week we bring you sounds from the past. Today, it's The Great Grey Ghost, a documentary that tells the story of the flight and crash of the Zeppelin.
We sustained slight burns about our hands and chiefly round our backs, about the neck, which was bare. We had turned our backs to the wind and weather and fire to keep it out of our eyes and faces generally. And having got under the port quarter, it was only natural that we should shout out for any further survivors. to let them know our position. Well, lucky enough, we heard one voice calling, and it was the voice of Mr. Leach. And he came walking round from the starboard side of the ship, round the stern, under the port quarter, to where we were. Of course, he was burned badly. His arms were out straight and head was burned. And the three of us hung on there for a short time until some kind of help could get to us.
I found one man in the bow of the ship, a fellow named Church, who felt sorry because he died just after. And we found another one, a fellow named Radcliffe.
He fell through and scrambled out of the ship somehow, but unfortunately he died that day. And Mr. Victor Savory, another engineer. The only people who were saved in this disaster was men who were encased in metal, who missed the fire and blast of the hydrogen.
Except wireless operator Arthur Disley, who half asleep and half awake in his bunk in the crew's quarters somehow survived the blast of 5,500,000 cubic feet of hydrogen, the least injured. It was Harry Leach who found him.
I came across Disley, the wireless operator, under a flaming oil tank, and we got him out, and he was in good enough condition to send to telephone to the Air Ministry and let them know what had happened.
I do remember one thing I said. I said, my goodness, it took us about 6 years to build that, and we've destroyed it in 2 minutes.
On October 22nd, under the Air Navigation Act, a full inquiry was ordered under Sir John Simon. The Secretary of State for Air was dead. The Director of Civil Aviation was dead. The Chief AID Inspector was dead. From the Royal Airship Works, Wing Commander R.B. Colmore, the Director of Airship Development, and five of his senior men were all dead. Flight Lieutenant Carmichael Irwin, Captain, his first officer, the navigator, and the Met officer, all dead. For six difficult and sometimes frustrating years, they had lived and breathed this modern giant of the sky, and they had died for her and with her, a mistress they hardly knew. It might even be said that she was never even intended to fly a scheduled route. She was a prototype, and was so thought of by at least one member of her design team, Sir John Baker.
There's no doubt that the aim of the two ships was what we would call now a research program. But I believe to get the money, Parliament had to be told what amounted to a pack of lies. I believe that the specification was that the ship should fly to India. We, on the design program, as far as I remember, knew that what we were tackling was a very difficult design job of a prototype, which was to fly. I suppose we thought where it was going to fly, but I don't remember that particularly. I approve of the aim. Of course, this was a tremendous engineering adventure.
To Wing Commanders Cave Brown Cave and Rafe Booth, the development of the dirigible had a more practical application.
Rigid airships really started from the Zeppelin's work in Germany in 1900, where he carried out a program of regular step-by-step development of one ship built on the experience gained of the previous one.
Our objective was imperial communications to the west and to the east. And at that time, in 1924-25, there seemed no chance of heavier-than-air doing these long transoceanic trips in flying boats or in heavier aircraft. And it had been suggested, even before the scheme started, perhaps it might be possible to cooperate with the Germans so as to have an international airship company. But so soon after the war, I don't think people thought it was a possibility for the near future. So we had to go ahead on our own. Possibly we jumped a bit too far ahead to build these very big ships without really very much previous design knowledge of that very big type of airship. And of course our crews were learning as we went along. We hadn't the background of the German officers and crews.
From 1920 to 1924, various airship plans were submitted, studied, and discarded by the government of the day. The most realistic plan, based on practical commercial considerations, was submitted in 1922 by Commander Sir Denniston Burney on behalf of a group composed of Burney, Vickers Aircraft, and Shell Petroleum, to be known as the Airship Guarantee Company. Delay, followed the downfall of the Lloyd George Coalition, followed the retirement of Bonner Law and the consequent succession of Stanley Baldwin to the premiership. Though the Burney scheme had been finally adopted in principle in mid-1923, the Airship Guarantee Company's troubles were not yet over. In January of 1924, the first Labour government was formed under Ramsay MacDonald. The newly formed Labour government did not want to nationalise the Burney scheme for fear of annoying the Liberals, on whom they were dependent in Parliament. It was not a happy solution, and least of all, to Sir Denis Burney.
When the Labour government came in, they were rather addicted to state enterprise, and they thought it would be better to have a state enterprise ship as well as a private enterprise ship. And I remember going to a special cabinet meeting that was set up to consider the matter, which Jimmy Thomas was in the chair, and the First Lord of the Admiralty and the Secretary of State for Air was there, who was then Lord Thomson. And I remember Jimmy Thomas saying to Lord Thomson, "How are these two ships going to be built?" And Lord Thomson replied, "Oh, in a spirit of friendly emulation." Jimmy Thomas said, "What do you mean, Thomson? Bloody competition?" And that is how they were built.
And so the race was on. At the Royal Airship Works at Cardington, the R101, a scientific program for airship development. At Howden, a plan for immediate development of high-speed imperial communications represented by the R100. Though few, if any, of the new generation had had any real experience in the actual design of a rigid airship, it was a technically well-qualified team headed by Assistant Director Technical, Lieutenant Colonel V.C. Richmond.
Richmond really wasn't a designer at all. Richmond was a most extraordinary man. He was an enthusiast. I forget what his background was, but he wasn't an engineer, or at least hadn't been trained in an orthodox way as an engineer, but he had a passion for airships.
He had had a long experience of non-rigid airships. He was a qualified scientist. He was a good leader of a team, and he had some very good people in his team. And I believe that that team, led by Richmond, was utterly competent to design the airship.
The R100 followed much more closely Zeppelin methods of construction. An airship can really be divided up into the transverse frames and the longitudinal members that run the length of the ship. Between the transverse frames, of course, you have the gas bags. And the Zeppelin-type construction, the transverse frames were like bicycle wheels. They had radial wires giving them strength in their own plane. Whereas in the R101, the transverse frames had no radial wiring. They were space frames. They were triangular in section, big, deep triangles. And so they obtained their strength by their own structural rigidity without relying on radial wires.
And this rigidity was to be further reinforced by the use of stainless steel rather than the traditional duralumin. A new system for containing the gas bags was developed, a form of parachute harness of wires to suspend the bags within the transverse frames to keep them from rubbing. In favor of low fuel consumption costs and supposed greater safety, the standard petrol engine was to be supplanted by a rail car type diesel engine.
We stuck to the diesel engines, which proved so terrifically heavy that I think they were one of the chief causes of the final trouble. Had they been lighter engines, we should not have been in the weight difficulties, which indeed, in the end, we were.
When she came out on October 12, 1929, she was 724 feet long by 131 feet wide by 140 feet high. She weighed 113 tons instead of the intended 90. Her disposable lift was only 148 tons instead of the specified 156 tons. Electric fans pulled air through radiators, hot in the winter and cool in the summer. Only the control car hung below the hull. The chart room was above it, and the passenger accommodations above that again. The smoke room was aluminum-lined to lessen the danger of fire. The main lounge was 60 feet by 32 feet, fitted with green cane settees. With a spacious dining room and full galley and a safety glass-enclosed promenade, she was a model of luxury and comfort. The only things that really marred her beauty were the technical failures, which were to combine exactly a year to the month later to bring about her destruction. At 11:20 a.m. on the 14th of October, she flew off on her first trial flight. By this date, the total program had cost the nation nearly £2 million.
After 101 had done her first few flights and was obviously flying quite satisfactorily, the difficulty was that she had less useful lift than had been expected. I don't think that the action which was taken to meet that deficiency was sufficiently drastic, and I think that the reason it was not more drastic was some reluctance to admit that the deficiency from what had been expected was as great as it was.
Her ultimate fate seems to have been sealed when in December of 1929 it was announced that the R-101 would undergo minor alterations to improve her useful lift.
The methods they employed were to take out certain pieces of machinery which had proved to be unnecessary because the controls of the airship worked much better than had certainly been expected. Then they decided to let out the gas bag wiring so that the gas bags could extend to fill the space available more completely. And then they decided that they would also part the ship in the middle and put in an additional section. That gave them an extra 8.7 tons.
Up to the end of 1929, she had flown a total of 73 hours and 27 minutes.
Now, when she went out on there, I think, June the 23rd, they hooked her onto the mast, you see, and her cover started to billow. And I said to our engineer, who was Stoppel, he was watching with me from the shed at the time, I said, "That cover will go in a minute." And I'd no sooner said it than it started to rip right along the top, and it stripped the cover for about 90 feet. And that happened, I think, a second time.
Her cover was repaired, and she took her first post-refit flights on June 26th, 27th, and 28th, 1930. During these flights, she began to show alarming characteristics. Captain George Meagher, first officer of the R-100, was in her, and took a watch.
We made a dip in a form of salute as we went by the whole crowd of people. Most of the critics thought that she dipped down involuntarily, but it was a definite salute to the crowd of people. Well, then, after we'd done our flight over the pageant, we went up north towards Bedford, and it got very bumpy. I mean, the ship was going up and down and being thrown about a bit. And about 4 o'clock, I suppose, the ship seemed to get heavier and heavier. And Elton, he was on the elevator control, he's one of the coxswains, and he was simply pouring with sweat trying to hold her up. He'd get her up to decent height, say 1,200, 1,500, and then he'd level her out, which is a normal thing, of course. And then down she'd go again, nose down. And then he'd do the same again. And this happened 2 or 3 times, and I was watching. I said, "You're having a bit of trouble holding her up, aren't you, Elton?" And he says, "Yes, sir, it's as much as I can do to hold her up." So on that, I let go about a ton of ballast, you see. I thought, well, this is no good. Sooner or later, we're going to hit the deck. So I let go about a ton of ballast, and I said, "How's that, Elton?" He said, "Oh," he said, "that's much easier," and carried on. Well, a little later, that would have been somewhere about 6. Irwin came down, that's the captain of the ship, and of course I reported to him that I'd let go this ballast. He always said, we never let go any ballast during flight. We always reserve it for landing. Well, when they came into land, they had to let go, I think it was somewhere about 10 tons of emergency ballast. That is oil and water. Of course, the oil only was emergency. The water was normal. And, of course, that's not a usual thing with an airship. I mean, if you go out for 24 hours on a flight, you generally come in and you're as light as a feather and have to let go gas. In our 100, we never once let go any emergency ballast. In fact, as far as I remember, we never let go any ballast come into land at all. But R101, practically every long flight she did, not the short ones, she had to let go emergency ballast. And that made me think there's something wrong with her.
He was right, of course. There was something wrong with her. It wasn't long after that that the R101 crashed and burned. By the way, you can see dramatic footage of the German Hindenburg as it frantically released ballast in order to right itself before it, too, crashed and burned. That's at the Rewind website at cbc.ca/rewind. I'm Michael Enright.
Was she losing gas from the newly designed gas release valves that opened automatically whenever the R101 rolled more than 4 degrees? And she did roll a lot. Or was it the gas bags themselves? There were no innovations here. They were of standard construction, tried and true. Cotton covers lined with specially prepared squares of oxen intestines called gold beater's skins. J.W.W. Dyer was the chief chemist at Cardington.
They are as near to an impervious material as you can get when they're in good condition. If they did leak, and I should say that I'm quite sure all gas bags leaked in all airships, it was because of small fractures here and there. But at one stage in the R101, there was the added worry of the pressing of the gas bags on the longitudinal frames themselves.
The one thing the novel gas bag wiring was designed to stop had been destroyed in the refit by letting out the parachute harness. In trying to solve one problem, her designers had posed themselves another.
I had had talks with Rope about the seriousness of this from the point of view of a loss of gas through holes. But never again after that, when, so far as my memory serves, the padding had been done and the gas bags still pressing on these girders were protected from chafing. I must say that I myself always thought that it was rather a botch to have to pad these girders, but there were authorities and the inspector who would be satisfied himself that they were satisfactory.
When she was rehoused on June 29th, she had flown 102 hours, 56 minutes. Her reconstruction completed, R101 was brought out from her shed for the last time on October the 1st. On October 1st and 2nd, she flew 16 hours and 51 minutes, her only trial with the new bay in place. She had never had full speed trials, and at 777 feet, she was the biggest thing afloat, in the air or on the sea. On her day of departure, October 4th, 1930, she had made 11 flights and was still over 83 hours short of trial time. It was with great reluctance that the Aeronautical Inspection Department agreed to grant a certificate of airworthiness. What were the pressures that dictated the start of the flight without proper trials, despite the considerable alteration of the hull? Once the R100 had successfully made her double crossing of the Atlantic, the pressure for the flight to India was almost irresistible from both a political and technical point of view. This miracle of modern aviation had been under the microscope of a well-meaning but ill-informed press and public for 6 years, and perhaps most important, the fate of the Labour government's nationalization approach was at stake, and so was that of the Royal Airship Works.
It was decided that the ship must leave at that time because Colmore, the director, said he had been told quite definitely that unless the airship did manage to get to India and back again in time for the Imperial Conference, no more money would be available for airships and none would be asked for. That was undoubtedly the pressure that was on Colmore in the last stages.
In retrospect, she seems to have been ill-prepared for the dawn of October 4th. But was she thought to be by those who knew her best?
Carnington had the greatest confidence in the ship they had built, and they might have gone as far as saying, well, the critics might have said, we haven't done all our trials, and I think Irwin would agree that he hadn't done all the trials he wanted to, but he agreed that by force of circumstances and possibly propaganda, it would be a jolly good thing to do this flight. So that the most pessimistic feeling was, well, that night might have been, oh, well, it's not very good weather. Anyhow, she can get off, and if it gets worse, she can come back.
One of the most experienced men in the business was her meteorological officer, M.A. Giblet. There is no evidence to indicate that he was overly concerned about the weather. Nor, according to his friend and fellow meteorologist, Colonel Ernest Gold, should he have been.
Well, the conditions at Cardington were relatively quiet conditions on October the 4th, but there was what would be called now a trough approaching from the Atlantic, and that trough approached rather more rapidly and more intensely than it was possible to foresee in the morning of October the 4th. But it was possible to glimpse it in the middle of the day, and by 6 o'clock in the evening, it was possible to see with definiteness that that trough was advancing and would be affecting conditions over the airship's route in northern France during the night. Although the wind became stronger than had been anticipated, it wasn't a wind which an airship wouldn't expect to meet in the course of its operations. It was a strongish wind, but 40 to 50 miles an hour at 1,500 feet or 2,000 feet is not at all an exceptional wind. There was no definite evidence of a thunderstorm, but there was definite evidence of heavy rain about just before the time the airship was at Beauvais. The important topographical feature is the hill to the west-southwest of Beauvais, which rises to about 600 feet. Those two factors would not have been exceptional factors for an airship well found and operating in a normal way. But they would contribute if the airship was not operating normally but had lost height.
At 12 o'clock, all was satisfactory. If the ship had been losing gas from 6:30 till 12 due to gas bag friction or something like that, we must credit, I think, that the officers and crew with enough knowledge and experience to recognize this fact. So I think we can discount any suggestion in the ship that she was losing gas gradually ever since she left England. Well, they changed watches at 2 o'clock, and we have evidence that at 2 o'clock all was normal on board. The watches changed, which they wouldn't have done, of course, if there'd been any sign of anxiety or that the captain had decided that something was possibly wrong with the gas bags. He would have had all the crew out examining and on call in case of any emergency, but nothing like that happened. So we got up to 2:05, everything was all right. I think that indicates something catastrophic happening and no gradual build-up of lack of airworthiness. Engine bells rang, the engines were stopped on a second dive. She hit at an extreme angle of pitch. That extreme angle of pitch can't really be accounted for by wrong manipulation of control surfaces. She wouldn't have gotten to that extreme angle unless something catastrophic had happened. Her elevators were found hard up when she was inspected the following day, and The problem ever since has been what really did happen. Well, it seems, I think, looking back, basically there must have been a catastrophic loss of gas in one of the forward gas cells. Now, the gas cells were definitely of fragile construction, very adversely affected by extreme damp conditions, so that I think one could assume that the gas bags forward were pretty wet because of very damp air blowing into them for 6-7 hours. That would weaken the seams. Now, if over France she was even normally pitching, there's a good deal of vertical acceleration right forward. The bar would be lifting and dropping, and your gas bags would be under strain due to this acceleration. I won't necessarily say they were in contact with anything. If you had an extreme loss of gas from one of these forward gas bags, the majority of that would surge right aft in the ship at an extraordinary speed, because gas, after all, is 25 times lighter than air or something like that, so that it shoots up at an extraordinary speed right up to the tail, giving her an added lift aft, added bow down forward. She must have had this sudden loss of gas. The gas must have gone aft, lifted the tail up, and given her that extreme angle of pitch. And that's why she hit.
Sir John Simon and the Court of Inquiry came to the same conclusion, that she came down owing to a loss of lift at the bow. But the National Physical Laboratory and the airworthiness experts, following experiments recreating the conditions described by the court, found that under these conditions the airship would have descended tail first. Exactly what caused the final disaster to His Majesty's airship R-101, no one is ever likely to know, and there are very few who care.
They might have had a limited part to play, and I hope they would, had there been no disaster. But as it is, they're just great grey ghosts.
Following the crash of the R-101, His Majesty's airship R-100 never flew again. She was broken up and sold as scrap, reputedly for £500. Tonight's program included the voices of the captain and first officer of the R-100, Wing Commander Rafe Booth and Captain George Meeker, the designer, Dr. Barnes Wallace, and the director of the Airship Guarantee Company, Commander Sir Denniston Burney. Members of the R-101's design and construction crew were Lord Kings Norton, Sir John Baker, and Wing Commander Cave Brown Cave. The survivors were Joe Binks, Arthur Bell, Harry Leach, Alfred Cook, and Arthur Disley. The widow of First Engineer William Rose Gent, Air Ministry Duty Officer Sir Morris Dean, meteorologist Colonel Ernest Gold, and chemist J.W.W. Dyer contributed much of their time and were heard briefly.
The Great Grey Ghost, the story of the fated R-101 that put an end to research into passenger-carrying airships in Britain. However, other countries pushed ahead with research and trials with the airships, invariably with disastrous results. In 1933, the USS Akron was destroyed in a thunderstorm off the coast of New Jersey, killing 73 people on board. And in 1937, the Hindenburg burst into flames and crashed with 37 fatalities. That pretty well ensured the end of large passenger-carrying dirigibles. Rigid airships are still in use, mostly for advertising and geological surveys. But now they use helium, which is not flammable, rather than the cheaper hydrogen, which is highly flammable. And that's all the time we have for Rewind today. I hope you enjoyed the program. Please have a look at the Rewind website, where you can hear the show again. You can see pictures of the R-101 and the Hindenburg as it floated over Newfoundland and crashed and burned in New Jersey. You'll also see Len Chappell, who produced the documentary. That's at cbc.ca/rewind. Please send us an email and tell us what you thought. Was this a story that was familiar to you? Does innovation always lead to a wrong turn before it gets it right? Does politics sometimes trump safety, in your opinion? Please let us know what you think. We're at rewind at cbc.ca. That's rewind at cbc.ca.